Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh, and welcome to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Among the hot topics on today's agenda, the controversial comments of a Supreme Court justice and the fallout. A former member of the Cardinals' front office is going to prison for a long time for hacking another team's computers. And there's an effort to adjust Missouri's abortion restriction laws following a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Joining me in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. Back with us is Marcia McCormick of the St. Louis University School of Law. Thank you all for being with us and for listening to Joe Manus. I want to stay with the political part of this discussion for just a moment. Bill, I'll start with you. I mentioned Melania's plagiarism episode this week. What actually constitutes plagiarism? Apparently, she had 70 words that were similar to Michelle Obama's.
Yeah, well, I think 70 words and particularly the way that was constructed and the sort of order in which being the same order in which she presented the words as Michelle Obama, that would constitute plagiarism. Even just using a few very distinctive phrases can be plagiarism. So if it were one of my students, they'd probably get an F on the paper. Of course, plagiarism isn't a crime. I mean, the thing that could have legal implications is that. So it seems like it was an employee of Trump's who wrote the plagiarized lines.
And it's been admitted, in fact, the lines were lifted, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And if that's an employee of Trump's corporation, that is arguably a corporate contribution to a candidate. Those are still illegal.
Yeah. I'm still unclear as to how far one can go using words, someone else's words, without it becoming a problem.
Yeah, so legally, like Bill said, plagiarism is not illegal. There are certain industries where it's unethical, and Bill happens to have feet firmly planted in two of them. One is academics, and the other one is journalism. I mean, we take that very seriously at the university, and you've seen newspapers fire employees who were caught with plagiarizing. But legally, the closest that anything would come would be copyright infringement, and I don't think this is close enough for copyright infringement. So, the idea of copyright is you can borrow an idea. You just can't borrow the unique expression of an idea. That's what gets protected. And I looked at the quotes. I mean, they're pretty similar, and arguably, I mean, I guess you could try and make some kind of copyright claim, but I don't think it would go anywhere.
Can you get around it by just attributing what you're saying to
the fair use exception, right? So you're allowed to, copyright, you could say, and as Michelle Obama said, quote, you're fine.
Right. Yeah, and it's not plagiarism if you do the attribution. Of course, she didn't want to be giving credit to Michelle Obama.
Of course not. But this is not the first time it happened. I mean, remember, wasn't it Biden who that kind of derailed his presidential campaign when he got caught? And it's like, there are only so many ways to say things, and you hear, I mean, I'm not defending them, but I'm certainly much more comfortable with a phrase or two, but lifting paragraphs or lifting whole speeches, that's a different matter. But it's not journalism. It's not higher education.
It's
where
you're politics.
Politics. I got a very low bar. Right. Yeah.
Marcia, do you have any thoughts on?
Well, I just think it is politically significant that, given all of the other things going on in the country, that she was representing the words of a very strong black woman as her own, and the fact that she was appropriating that particular person had a lot of legs politically, I think.
Yeah. Another part of this is it's very, very difficult to get away with plagiarism anymore, right? Given this digital world that we're living in. I mean, within an hour, it was out that this material.
When I get papers from students, I don't know if you have this, you guys, but you can run it. We have this program. You can run it through, and it'll tell you, there's like a 98% chance it was plagiarized off the internet, or it's only a 20% chance, and it'll do little phrases. So, it's really hard to slide by anymore with
sure.
that.
Unless there's something else to add to this, let's move along to the comments made a couple of weeks ago by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in which she was highly critical of Donald Trump. He responded, of course, by saying that her mind was shot, I think was the expression that he used, just trading compliments here. Marcia, let me begin with you. What does this mean for her and for the court, would you think? Will this go away?
I think that actually it will probably go away. I will confess, Justice Ginsburg, I think, is probably one of my personal heroes. If Justice Scalia had said something similar about President Obama, there would not have been, I think, as big a flap about it, because he was very famous for saying acerbic things, and everyone sort of expected it. But the fact that Justice Ginsburg was the one who said something, I think, made it seem more outrageous to people, and made people who were more middle of the road a little concerned about her role on the court and in the context in which she said it. Overall, she's appointed for life, and I just don't think that it's going to have any real bearing going forward. If Justice Scalia could hunt with Dick Cheney and not recuse himself from Halliburton cases, there is just not really going to be an issue, I think, in terms of the court's work.
Unless we look at a situation such as surfaced in 2000, in which the presidential contest went before the Supreme Court. People are saying she would have to recuse herself.
Well, there are no legal rules for the Supreme Court about recusal. It's totally up to the justices and their own discretion about whether to step out of a case. And Justice Kagan actually has been very liberal in that, in the sense that she has recused herself from anything that the Solicitor General's office was even remotely involved in while she was the Solicitor General. But there's a tradition of justices not recusing themselves, so I think she wouldn't have to, and I would be surprised if she did.
Would be up to her. The code of conduct only applies to the judges beneath the Supreme Court. Now, under that code of conduct, what she did would have been unethical because you're not supposed to comment on for or against the political candidate.
Yeah.
But as Marcia says, it's the Supreme Court justices decide on their own whether to recuse themselves, and she would not have to. But I think if you had a case that involved, you know, the outcome of the election, I think it'd be very hard for her to, after what she said, I think it'd be very hard for her to sit on that case. I think there'd be, the public outcry would be enormous.
Significant.
So much of the Supreme Court's power, when you look at the three branches of the government, you got the president, you got the Congress, and you got the courts. And, you know, I always say to my students, you know, the president's got the army that gives you power. Congress has got the money that gives you power. The courts, they just got some snappy looking robes. That's all. The only power they have is this institutional power that comes over time with people believing in them. And so I don't think she and also I think when we talk about ethic, there are like legal ethics, which are rules that that lawyers are bound by and that judges are bound by. Those are pretty specific. And then you have these kind of philosophical ethical rules. I mean, when you look at the rules, if she had been a lower judge, she would have violated an ethical rule, but they don't apply to her. I still think it was probably not the wise thing to do because it undermines the kind of the institutional
authority, legitimacy.
Legitimacy of the court because they're supposed to stay out of politics and everything. But and I think she should, but there's nothing that would require her to recuse herself if something came up.
I mean, I'm very sympathetic to her saying what she did because I mean, she is a civil rights legend.
Lord, yeah.
She was the lawyer who brought most of the sex discrimination cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, before she was on the Supreme Court. And so, you know, you can see why with this kind of background, you know, how can she not talk about this presidential candidate who's this obvious male chauvinist and
has contempt for the Constitution and has basically said he doesn't have to follow it if he's president. I mean, there's a legitimacy to her argument that this is unprecedented. That would be different in another context, I think.
Is there a double standard here? And I have to take a break in just a moment. We have a tweet from Hillary who writes, discuss why RBG's comments were treated differently than Alito's or Scalia's. I guess the Scalia reference is to going hunting with Cheney, and the Alito is when he said not true during the State of the Union message when President Obama said something about the court. Is there a double standard here?
Well, that's what you were saying. Yeah. And I don't know. I think
those are a little different, I think.
Yeah. And it's not – it's here it was talking about a political candidate kind of endorsing, not endorsing. Not true is – it's your belief that something is not true.
You know, there was a very strong argument that Scalia should have recused himself in that case.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the liberal commentators were saying he should,
right.
But he refused to.
Right.
So, you know, you got to come up with a principle that works both ways. You know, just because we like Ruth Bader Ginsburg doesn't mean we necessarily can give her a pass.
Well, this political year, who knows what's going to happen at the end of it on November 8th and beyond that. Let's take our break now, come back and continue our discussion of other issues. This is Legal Roundtable Day. We're in studio with Mark Smith from Washington University, Marcia McCormick from St. Louis University, and Bill Freivogel from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Back to continue this discussion in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Marcia McCormick, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith, our Legal Roundtable panelists of the day. Let's move along to the Chris Correa story. Chris Correa is the former Cardinals scouting director, the baseball Cardinals, that is, of course, sentenced to 46 months in prison and fined $279,000 for hacking the computers of the Houston Astros baseball team. This is evidence, I guess, that this crime is taken very, very seriously, Mark. What do you think?
Well,
46 months is a very stiff sentence.
Well, he had the misfortune to violate a federal law that has very stiff penalties. And so I think for each count, he could have gotten, I think, up to 5 years. He pled guilty to 5 counts. Now, you would do that concurrently. And you said, I think it was like 46 months or something he got. I can't remember.
Yeah.
So if he, with good time, he would do, I think, about 85% of that. But, yeah, it's a serious crime. And he went in, I think they said something like 60 times. So I think the interesting things will be, you know, so that was the criminal thing. And even though I'm not a big sports fan, I mean, I think Major League Baseball might still do something, and they might do something to the Cardinals. They might say – they might launch an investigation, kind of like they did for Pete Rose, to see, you know, did other people know this? Because he was, from what I understand, a pretty senior person.
Yeah.
And so there's some suggestion that maybe other people knew that this was going on. And will they then – even if they don't find other people knowing, will they impose some kind of penalties on the Cardinals? You know, you lose I don't know what they do, draft picks or something like that. This is a serious crime. So for people listening, you know, if you decide you want to hack at your workplace because you think you can figure out the password, my advice would be don't.
Don't do it. Well, this is, yeah. Any thoughts, Bill or Marcia, on this case?
No, I would just say it sounds right, the right amount of time for hacking a computer, but it would surely be unjust and terrible if there were any kind of sanctions on the Cardinals.
Yeah, you're really pandering to the audience there, Bill.
Spoken like a true Cardinals fan. Okay, moving along now. Let's talk about the tobacco tax, which I guess is going to be on the ballot in November here in Missouri. We could increase the tobacco tax by up to $1.27 a pack, I think it is. What we're dealing with here is the Secretary of State, Jason Kander, is going to keep the proposed constitutional amendment increasing the tax on the ballot, even though the courts ruled it should not be. Marcia, it seems to me this is just setting up for a lawsuit down the road.
It likely is. Yeah. So the rules on getting initiatives onto the ballot require that there be a summary of the ballot initiative that is on the page when you're collecting signatures. Missouri Court of Appeals just ruled that the summary was not acceptable because it didn't include subsequent raises in the tax that are possible. So they rewrote it. But those signatures with the valid summary had to be turned in 6 months before the election. So it's now the signatures they have probably don't comply with the law.
Right.
And it's too late to get them for this election. So the fact that it's going to be on the ballot and it was already challenged before it even got, you know, through the process, suggests to me that somebody's going to sue immediately.
to keep it off the ballot?
No,
or as soon as the result
is
in?
If it passes. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's the risk of going around collecting signatures. And I think there was litigation about this this proposal and the naming of it, the summary, when they were collecting the petition. So they're no good if you get the wrong summary. So they were taking a very risky strategy, and it looks like it failed.
I mean, this whole proposition, this tobacco tax initiative is, I mean, it's like you're from the Twilight Zone or something, where you have Reynolds, the big tobacco people pushing it, and you know they're trying to get at the little tobacco companies and put a bigger tax on them, and then there's this, okay, so it's for early childhood education, but it's also, you know, it's going to be potentially can be given to religious schools as well. You can't use any of the money for stem cell research. So there's all sorts of hidden agendas in this. And I really do not understand how candor. I mean, the law is pretty clear. It says signatures shall not be counted if the official ballot is not affixed to the page containing such signatures. The official ballot, which is the one that was approved by the appeals court, which is now the one approved by the appeals court in the Western District of Missouri, that was not attached to the 300,000 signatures I've got. I don't see how those can be counted. I don't know where candor is coming from.
I don't get it either. Yeah.
One of the things he is saying is the fact that it would disenfranchise the people who signed the petition if, in fact, it's not allowed to continue.
Who signed the petition under a false understanding of what it was about.
Right.
That argument doesn't go anywhere, I don't think.
I agree with Bill. I don't see how I think this is going to not go anywhere.
So it's still unclear as to whether or not it's going to be on the ballot. And if it is on the ballot, the result, if it passes, is probably going to be challenged.
That's I imagine.
That's our bottom line. Okay. Well, voters, take note of that. Okay. Speaking of legislation and things of that type, I'm under the impression that some Democratic Missouri legislators taking note of the Supreme Court decision of earlier this year concerning the Texas abortion restriction case, are going to try to undo the Missouri law. I guess my question as a novice to all of this would be, didn't the Supreme Court already undo that?
They were ruling in a Texas case. And so, I guess strictly what their ruling there applies in Texas. But, of course, they stated broad constitutional principles, which it would seem as though people in Missouri would be able to get applied in the federal courts here in Missouri. I mean, that Texas case, the Supreme Court said that the provisions of Texas law, which required a doctor to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital and for abortion clinics to meet ambulatory surgical center requirements, that there was no evidence that those kinds of provisions did anything for the safety of a woman, that they were unconstitutional. And so I think just the advocates in Missouri have got to find a way to, sort of the means by which to challenge the Missouri law, which has those very same provisions, almost identical.
Very, very similar to the Texas law that's been struck down. Any other thoughts with regard to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the argument is going to be that, the arguments of people who want to defend the law is that, maybe we can come up with more evidence. It was a very evidence-based decision. We'll have better experts. We'll have, or maybe the legislative history has something different in it. So legislators might say that they prefer to fight it out in the courts rather than to agree with the legislators who want to repeal the law that we have.
And I think, you've got this legislative action, but it's going to go nowhere because the Republicans control. So I assume this is just politics that they're doing this. I would assume on the judicial side, there's probably a standing issue. So I would, to kind of challenge the law, I have to be affected by the law. Isn't the only abortion provider is the Planned Parenthood one now in Missouri?
Yes, it's the one in here. In
yeah,
St.
that's
Louis
the
as
only
well.
One.
Yeah.
So you'd either have to have somebody who's trying to start a new one who could say, I don't want to comply with these things. But I think wouldn't standing be the issue to keep? You can't just go and say, we want some kind of ruling that this law is unconstitutional.
Well, no, my understanding, actually, standing was an issue in the Supreme Court's case. And my understanding is that they accepted the doctors as having standing, the doctors who would be performing the procedures.
Right.
And I'm not sure that so the law in Missouri doesn't go into effect until January 1, 2017, about admitting privileges. I'm not sure if Planned Parenthood's doctors currently in St. Louis have
all
admitting
these,
privileges.
So maybe Planned Parenthood could bring a challenge there.
Right.
Okay.
Well, plus the Columbia Clinic, which was, you know, closed because of this, because the University of Missouri, under pressure from the state legislature, took away admitting privileges from the doctor who performed abortions there. So it seemed to me like they clearly were damaged and put out of business by it. I think that the doctor in the Columbia at that clinic is challenging, or I think there's actually a reconsideration underway as to whether or not those admitting privileges were properly taken away.
Oh, okay.
I think there was a July hearing about it. So,
but here's a question that I think many people are asking who are not attorneys, and they look at the Supreme Court making a ruling on in the Texas case, and then they look at the Missouri law, which is very, very similar to it, and don't understand why that ruling in Texas doesn't just automatically apply to Missouri.
Well, it just requires subsequent legal action. I mean, it's sort of like the same thing with, in a way, with the same-sex marriage decision. I mean, that applied only very specifically to the cases before the court, but it was a general constitutional ruling that then, you know, people ended up going and getting individual laws struck down based upon that ruling. I mean, if you look at the overall, though, you know, one thing to think about is that even though the abortion rights folks have been winning in the Supreme Court, they've been able to keep the abortion right recognized under the Constitution, that if you look at – Missouri used to have 29 abortion clinics. Now there's one. And those – the statistics in other states are pretty similar. So on the ground, the anti-abortion people are doing pretty well.
I think to answer your question – I mean, the courts make decisions on the specific facts in front of them. And this, as Marcia was saying, is a fact-based. So they make a decision. And it's so it's like, you know, if my wife tells me you cannot play poker on Tuesday nights, that doesn't mean I can't – at least what I'm hearing is that doesn't mean I can't play poker on Wednesday nights, you know. And so until I get a ruling that says, no, you can't play on this night either, and so then – and it's the same kind of thing. Now, some, you know, legislatures can say, we think that what has come down, our laws are out of date and we need to update them. And you have laws on the books that may be in conflict with something in the court has said or the Constitution says, but it hasn't been ruled on yet. And then, you know, when it's challenged, they say, yeah, it doesn't apply. So that law is no good, but it's still out there until then.
And this sometimes takes a long time. I was just writing –
because people don't like the law or they don't want to change it.
You know? I was just writing the other day about Missouri's history of school segregation. And I think, if I'm remembering right, that it wasn't until 1976 that Missouri actually removed legal segregation from either its laws or from its constitution. That's a long time after 1954.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. My question to you, Mark, is what if your wife says you're not allowed to play poker any night?
Well, then that leaves open the days. And so, see, so
well,
until
and your
I
children.
Get a little,
and yeah. Your children. So who knows whether they can play poker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's, you know, there's always ways to get to where you want to go. That's
spoken,
what I find.
Spoken
yeah.
like a true attorney.
Yeah.
While we're on this subject, let's bring in Scott, who's calling from Chesterfield. He wants to get in on the abortion discussion. So go ahead, Scott. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think the pro-life movement, I think they need to change their strategy. You know, they've been backing Republicans all these years, mostly, and obviously it didn't pay off because of political reality. And I don't know. You know, I know there's some pro-lifers that are also pro-welfare, and, you know, they have a softer approach. And I think that's what they ought to look at, because I think I don't think most Americans, they don't, you know, the way it stands now, you look, the Supreme Court I mean, if they had overturned Roe, you know, there would have been a lot of angry women voters out there, and you know, and the Republicans would have lost, and they know that. And
all right, Scott.
Republicans have been using them all these years. So.
Scott, we've got your point. Let's see if anybody wants to comment on that. That's
well, just on the legal issue. I mean, this was a five. This whole women's health was a 5-3 decision, mm-hmm. and if you get a Democrat in place, putting another. I mean, there was a period of time where I think a lot of people were worried there was a chance Roe might be overturned, and if you get 6-3 going forward for a while, I think people will think that's not as likely to happen.
That's so. Just one of the reasons why during the current political discussion, as Joe Manis mentioned at the top, so much emphasis is being placed on the Supreme Court appointment this time. You know, year after year, we've talked about this, but yeah. Election cycle after election cycle, people don't realize
and
how
I think the fact that you
that
have
is.
An open seat has really crystallized it, because we've talked about it, but I think I don't hear other people talking about it. Now I hear people, just lay people talking about, oh, this is important because of the Supreme Court.
I mean, for this is such an important time, and we say this every 4 years, and people end up sort of ignoring it anyway in their decision, I think. But I mean, for several decades now, the majority of the Supreme Court has been Republican appointed justices who, in general, have voted on the more conservative side of issues. Now, this is a time when that. If Hillary Clinton is elected instead of Donald Trump, things could change. It'll be the first time in a long time that a majority of the justices on the court will have been appointed by a Democratic president. And it could very much – I mean, you know, back to the caller's point, Republicans are pro-life, anti-abortion folks supporting Republicans got them within one vote. One vote at one point of getting rid of Roe versus Wade, and so it got them close. So maybe it wasn't a poorly devised strategy. But if Hillary Clinton's elected and that majority becomes a 6-3, and then maybe even greater majority, then maybe this issue will recede.
And appointing a justice. Is and the courts of appeals and the district court judges, that's a 20-30 year legacy. That's a huge impact for a president, much more so than a lot of the other decisions that kind of come and go.
And they're suggesting that you'll have the number, I'm sure. I'm not quite sure of it. Suggesting that the next president will have 2, maybe 3 appointments during the course of the first term. Does that sound right to you?
It sounds reasonable.
Although Ginsburg has said she's not going anywhere.
Power to her.
Didn't Ginsburg in those comments make some sort of remark about how old Kennedy was getting?
She's a pip. Let's take a break. We'll do that now. Come back. Continue our discussion. It's Legal Roundtable Day. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 382-8255, if you'd like to join the discussion. You can also send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Our guests in studio, all attorneys, are Mark Smith from Washington University, Marsha McCormick of St. Louis University's School of Law, and also Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale. One thing I wanted to just get to and talk about briefly, folks, is the fact that a federal court in Texas yesterday ruled against – here's Texas again. Texas seems to be in the middle of everything these days – has ruled against part of the Texas voter ID law. Do we have any sense of what the ramifications of that particular ruling are likely to have anyplace else, including here in Missouri? Marcia?
The short answer is it is a long and complicated opinion. And part of the – so there are a couple of ramifications. One is that very difficult to get state IDs might violate the Voting Rights Act as causing a disparate impact on African-American or Hispanic voters. And the Court of Appeals found that that was enough to possibly enjoin part of the law or enforcement or change part of the law. What's really also interesting, the district court in this case originally had found that Texas's law was passed with the purpose to discriminate on the basis of race. And it's been reported that the Court of Appeals actually reversed that, but they didn't really reverse. They said there wasn't enough evidence to conclude that based on what you've told us, but we're remanding it. We're sending it back to the trial court to decide whether or not this other evidence that we think is enough shows that there was a discriminatory intent. And they kind of laid out a roadmap of how to do that. Look at Texas's history, look at this, that, and the other thing. And that would show intentional discrimination, leaving open the possibility that the law actually could be struck down as violating the Voting Rights Act in its entirety. But it's unclear. The district court still has to do stuff.
Well, these voter ID laws are popping up and being challenged all over the country, aren't they?
Yeah.
Including here in Missouri also. Any further thoughts on that, gentlemen?
But just, you know, looking at it from the long view, it's just really too bad that we're still talking about disenfranchising people from voting all these years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, at one point, the Voting Rights Act was so popular that it had real bipartisan support in the Congress. Look what we have now.
Do you think there's more activity on this particular issue right now? And by right now, I mean over the last year and a half or so, because of the political season. I mean, the political season's been going on for more than a year already. Does that generally tend to push these things forward?
Well, in part, but there's been a really concerted push to pass stricter voter ID laws after the Supreme Court decided a case that limited the Voting Rights Act a few years ago. And so I think it's the combination of those two.
I agree. Yeah, because we've been talking about this for a while, and then there was the big Supreme Court case, which seemed to embolden everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to get to, one or two things left on our agenda here, is that Governor Nixon has signed the Shield Law, which basically is a privacy law dealing with the police use of cameras. Bill, this is an issue I know in which you've been most interested in over the years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I generally think when I hear the term Shield Law, I think of it more in terms of shielding reporters to protect their confidential sources. This is shielding policemen and police departments from videos, taken officially or obtained during an official investigation, keeping those from being released. I mean, the video, as I understand the law, the videos that would be from officer squad cars or from the cameras that they might wear on their person, that video would not be a public record as long as there was an active investigation. Mm-hmm. And once an investigation was no longer active, then people could try to obtain that video. But then there's all sorts of procedures also for trying to keep it out of the public view. So it just seems like a little bit of a police department protection act.
Yeah, folks would have to go to court ultimately to have access to these videos.
I disagree with Bill on this one because, we have in the city of St. Louis, I don't know what I bet we've got about 1,200 officers right now in the streets. So that's 1,200 cameras roaming around the city. If we said we're going to put up 1,200 cameras all over the city just to monitor everything's going on and anyone could get that, I wouldn't like that, particularly if one of those cameras coming into my home, which a police officer might do. And so you're telling me the police officer comes into my home and everything is videotaped and that becomes public record? That seems very, George Orwell to me, and I'm not thrilled with that. The other thing is, I think we need to think about, if I'm a police officer and I've got this camera on my person and I'm on for an 8-hour shift, you're telling me I got to leave the camera on when I go to the bathroom, when I'm just sitting around talking to the other cops about football or something. I'm not as comfortable with that either. So I think there's a tension. On the one hand, we want accountability, but we also want, I think, privacy and we want a respect for individuals' privacy. And I think we can still get these records. It's just going to take some time. But I don't think it should just be automatic.
Well, and the people in them, the people who are filmed, can get them just by asking. So it's not It's not designed to keep the people who might want to challenge what's happened to them from having access to the videos.
But do I understand it right that if people then get those requests and get those films that they cannot publicly release them or describe them until they have told everybody else whose picture is in those photos that they are included and give those people a chance to go to court and say they don't want their picture taken? I mean, I just think that we have seen the power. I'm all for protecting people's privacy rights, but we've seen the power of the video in, you know, showing the public that there seem to be instances where police abuse their use of force when chasing or in dealing with particularly African American suspects and. You know, I just as a I guess I have the instinctual feeling as a reporter that okay, you have a not controversial incident out there. It's a live investigation. Are we not going to be able to? Are they going to be able to hide the ball on that?
Yeah, the bigger concern, I think, the way the discussion has been framed in the past has been an officer walks into a domestic dispute in someone's home. The husband and wife are screaming at each other or hitting each other or what have you. It's all being videotaped that ultimately it's going to be an embarrassing situation.
Well, the other thing is if I come into your home and you guys are – and then you stab somebody and my camera catches it, I mean, if you gave me a confession, I would have to give you your Miranda rights. I've got even a better way of recording what you said, and I haven't given you any kind of warning. The other thing is, in these cameras, I still think there needs to be some way to turn them on and off, and I know that's troublesome, but if I'm a victim of rape or domestic violence or something, and I'm something involving gangs where I'm concerned about some kind of repercussions, I may say to the police, I don't want to be on a camera. I'll tell you, but you can't put me on camera, and I think we should be able to deal with that. So I think it's complicated, and I think it's continuing to evolve. But I do think we'll be able to get them, or at least that's what I hope. I also understand that just because the police department could still release them, they don't have to keep them private, right? I can assert that right, but I don't have to.
I'm not sure it says any person, and it's a misdemeanor.
Really?
Yeah. At least.
Yeah. Would there be any distinction, difference, if the person who was filmed in one of these domestic disputes, let's just say, were a public person, a politician, a celebrity? I mean, sometimes...
Well, that would seem to increase the public interest in seeing something that was in a private space. But I guess, when people argue for it, well, there should be privacy on behalf of the people in this domestic disturbance. I understand that. I'm concerned that that's a little bit of a cover for trying to keep these films of things that are happening actually in public spaces out on the street from being disclosed at a time when there's a controversy over the actions of public officials in their carrying out law enforcement duties.
Might be a way to fine-tune the law, make a distinction between public and private. And they've got a little bit of that in there, I think.
But it's sort of
particularly
extra.
Well done. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the time that remains, let's talk a little bit about the desegregation suit that has been bouncing around for quite a while now. It involves a young student from the city who has moved to the county. He's a young African-American who wants to return to his charter school in the city, but it's not allowed because you can't travel that way under the voluntary deseg plan. What are the grounds for the dismissal? A federal judge has dismissed this lawsuit filed on behalf of the family who wants the kid to return to the city school. What are the grounds for dismissal,
Well, there's several grounds. I mean, this is Judge Ronnie White, who we've talked about before.
African-American.
He was, I believe, the first African-American Missouri Supreme Court justice.
One that John Ashcroft kept from becoming a federal judge, as I recall.
That's correct. So, but let's see. So, I mean, one thing he says in here, in his order, is that the young man doesn't have standing. In other words, he doesn't have the right to go to court to make this claim. And one reason for that is that the Voluntary Interdistrict Choice Corporation is not in charge of who goes to charter schools. It's in charge of who goes to city magnet schools. And so they don't make the decision about who goes to the charter schools. And Ronnie White also points out that the rules for when county children who are white can transfer to magnet schools in the city of St. Louis to advance desegregation, that those rules are rules that are part of the long running St. Louis school desegregation case, and they were approved by a federal judge, Judge Limbaugh, and they are in compliance with the 14th Amendment of the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause. And so for the Pacific Legal Foundation, on behalf of this child and mother, for the Pacific Legal Foundation to claim, well, you know, that whole desegregation plan never was, it was never really constitutional in the first place. I mean, this is a very radical claim that the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is a very, you know, a very strong right-wing legal foundation, this is a very radical claim they've made, that the school desegregation orders in St. Louis were never proper, were never in compliance with the Constitution. And Judge Ronnie White is saying they were approved by a federal judge. This has already been litigated. Mm-hmm. You can't bring it up anymore. I think he used the term race judicata. It's already something that's been decided.
Yeah. Yeah, a remedy for a constitutional violation cannot itself be a constitutional violation.
And I think it's already been announced that this ruling of Judge White's is going to be appealed, which I guess is just de rigueur for such things. Okay, as time winds down, I know that Mark wanted to get to this. And that is the fact that apparently it's a done deal now between Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and SAB.
Right. Because my other big vice besides poker is drinking beer. So I'm very concerned. I'm following all the big legal issues.
Sometimes both at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. That's when I'm the most fun. And this is – but I don't think it's really going to affect things in the United States that much, because you've got – InBev, which is this, I think, Belgian-based company, and Miller, which is, I think, South African. But Miller in the United States has a sub that's in partnership with Coors, and they're going to have to divest themselves of this. So it seems like InBev is just trying to get more international markets. But some of the things in the justice thing, so they said you got to divest Miller in the United States, and they said some things to try and keep Anheuser-Busch from discouraging craft brewers, so for people who like small batch beers, and that this should be a good thing, hopefully.
Right, but it is a done deal. It's going to happen.
Yeah, no, it's approved by the Department of Justice. I mean, this is an international thing. They've still got to get some. They're trying to do some stuff in China. I read somewhere that China looks like they're going to approve it. There may be something going on in South Africa too. So there are other countries obviously involved. Mm-hmm.
There are some attorneys who are getting wealthy dealing with this particular
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. That's the other thing that's all in favor of,
right? That's the end of our time, lady and gentlemen, for today's Legal Roundtable. Thank you all for being with us. Marsha McCormick, great to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Mark Smith, great to see you. And Bill Freivogel, of course, great to see you as well. We'll get together in about a month. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.